speaker this morning is Jonathan Harlow. We're just going to sort out sound in a moment. He's going to be talking about consciousness, a hard problem. And then we're just going to have, on your program there wasn't a little break, so we'll put in a little break between Mike's talk and Tim's one, so you can have a little comfort break in between. So, are you ready, Jonathan?
Between Mike's talk and Tim's talk.
Between Mike's talk and Tim's talk, yeah. So we may run just 5 minutes over. Between
Jonathan.
Between Jonathan. Sorry, Jonathan. Right, okay.
Good morning.
Thank you,
Jonathan. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Good. At this hour of Sunday morning, I think I could say, welcome back to consciousness. Now, developing a complete account of consciousness in half an hour should be a doddle, but what I mean to do is to address specific elements of the Chalmers problem as printed in the program. First, he deals with only one aspect of conscious activity, broadly qualia. And in response, I shall emphasise the limited, almost contingent role of this qualitative experience. Second, he characterises this as not physical and as subjective. And I shall present it as... Oops, come on, what are you? It just doesn't want to.
It's not conscious, I'm sure.
I shall present it as physical and as objective. Thirdly, he finds it as objectively unreasonable, and I shall argue that it makes good evolutionary sense. So, first, how important are qualia? They belong to one particular form of conscious activity, that of sensory perception. Most of the things that we consciously do don't seem to involve qualia at all. Extracting information, planning, problem solving, making or doing something, communicating, all things I do in conscious mode, and none of them seems to involve a special what-it-is-like feeling, nor does remembering, unless what is remembered is itself a sensory perception. I think that may be what Chalmers meant by entertaining a mental image. Now, Chalmers also includes emotions amongst these ineffable experiences. They don't seem to me to be the same sort as perceptual qualia. Vision is the final stage of a sensory process. It's what happens eventually when light hits our waking eyes. But anger is not, in the same way, a feeling that is the result of being angry. It is being angry. There's no difference between sadness and feeling sad. And okay, we are conscious of our emotions when they're strong, but as they become fainter, don't they become rather less distinctive, less what Chalmers characterises as something that it is like to feel? I have a cousin to whom I'm not very close, and I hear that her husband, whom I've never met, has cancer. I'm not lying when I say that I'm sorry to hear it, but does this really amount to a feeling, an attitude, a disposition to ameliorate or comfort? But it's a long way from feeling sad. Or as Dr. Johnson said, why, there's Baretti who's to be tried for his life tomorrow. Friends have risen up for him on every side. Yet if he should be hanged, none of them will eat a slice of plum pudding or less. Sir, that sympathetic feeling goes a very little way in depressing the mind. Altogether, then, I'm inclined to regard that the sort of emotion that one is conscious of as almost an interruption, an invasion of consciousness, rather than itself a conscious process. And anyhow, it doesn't seem very puzzling to explain it in physical terms. We don't scan for neural clusters or pathways. We look for great surges of chemicals washing over the whole system. And we find them. Adrenaline, or alcohol, cortisone, or cocaine. So I'm going to confine Chalmers' problem pretty much entirely to sensory perception. And the way I put it is that visual experience is how we register light waves. Sound is how we register air waves. Touch is how we register physical contact. Taste and smell are how we register chemicals. Now, a great deal is sometimes made of the point that I cannot tell whether you register red in the same way that I do. Of course, there is every reason to suppose that you do, but it may matter less how we register than that we register, i.e., recognize and identify. Does it matter if I register these light waves the same way as you do? My mobile ringtone may be different from yours. So what? As long as each of us recognizes our own and can tell it apart from the landline or the doorbell or the fire alarm. So for me, qualia play a contingent role in a very small region of our conscious activity. I note, too, that qualia are experiences which we most obviously share with many other animals, including insects, reptiles, and birds. Just check out the role of sight and sound in mating behaviour. Not to mention scent and touch. So, qualia, indeed a long-standing feature of animal life, playing little or no part in the many conscious activities by which humans seem distinctive. I can't see qualia as a central problem of human consciousness. So, now let me discuss Chalmers' claim that qualitative experience is somehow not physical, and that it is innerly subjective. Well, first, if vision or sound are not physical, then what are they? In 2017, Chalmers wrote a whole paper, Naturalistic Dualism, claiming that consciousness belonged to, or constituted, another sort of fundamental, parallel to matter, but not matter. And this claim has to face all the standard arguments against dualism. First, just what kind of entity is involved then? Just what does it consist of? How do we observe it? And in particular, how did it work? How does it interact with physical matter? And Chalmers seems hardly to acknowledge these questions, certainly comes up with no answers. Anyhow, it doesn't seem a necessary step. Why is not perception an entirely physical process? Take vision. It's an activity. It's not merely passive. It involves interaction, interrogation, prediction, filling in. It's an activity common to a great many sorts of animals. Visual perception appears to be merely the last stage in a physical process that we can observe and check. Yeah, check. At least with humans, by asking them. I can't ask birds directly, but can anyone doubt from their behaviour that they see the coloured world pretty much as we do? Bees register a few different wavelengths, but otherwise. We can also confirm the correlation of specific visual experiences with the activity of particular neural networks. And all these points apply to the other senses. And this brings me to a really striking point of our aquaria. So far from being part of that subjective inner life that Chalmers evokes, they are robustly and reliably objective. You look at a first-class postage stamp in ordinary light, and unless you are clinically colourblind, you see red. I look at it, same thing. Thousands look at it, same thing. So standard an effect that we can use it to organise traffic. Now, earlier, I suggested that perhaps it didn't matter that much whether you and I experienced red in the same way, so long as we recognised it as red. But listen to two critics discussing a picture. Can you really suppose that they're working from mutually inaccessible palettes of colour? What about two wine tasters? Do you really imagine that they're working from mutually inaccessible regions of taste and smell? After all, we're the same species, we draw on the same gene pool. We expect to work the same way. An interesting limiting. Of course, our perception of redness will vary with the lighting and with the other colours against which it appears, but these variations too are consistent and predictable, just as you'd expect from a physical process. An interesting limiting case here is synesthesia. People with synesthesia see numbers or words or letters as coloured, may even see sounds as coloured, though they hear them too. But there is a contrast to the objectivity of normal vision. Two synesthetists are not likely to agree on the colour of the number 8, or of a blast of B flat on the trumpets. So I think we can regard synesthesia as a sensory aberration, like colourblindness, not as a sensory enhancement like perfect pitch. Beyond colourblindness and short of synesthesia, what we think of as normal vision seems pretty robust. Indeed, our very standards of scientific verification depend 100% on the robust objectivity of human perception. Two observers will agree that in given circumstances the thermometer is indeed registering 20.1 degrees Celsius. And so will 20 observers. And so will 200, but excuse me the slide. If we didn't trust to the objectivity of human perception, science would be at a stop. And if sensory perception is, from beginning to end, a physical process, it follows that the right way to address it is by standard physical investigation. Chalmers is not happy with this. He wants to analyse the concept of consciousness and discuss the content of experience. We might just as well have philosophers discuss the concept of digestion, or the content of adopt operational terms, observe, devise experiments. Certainly the attempts to explain consciousness and mental activity by philosophical analysis have not been very productive. 2,500 years of philosophy have given us hardly any useful results at all. Neuroscience is very recent. Only 70 years ago, Ryle could write the concept of mind without mentioning neurons or brain imaging. Look at what we know today, all by virtue of standard scientific methodology plus technology. And now I'll turn to Chalmers' puzzlement. Why qualia? Note the apparent self-contradiction in his formulation. It seems objectively unreasonable. Because seeming unreasonable is hardly objective. It's pretty subjective. Just what are Chalmers' criteria? Many of us reckon that Prime Minister Johnson and President Trump are weirder than most science fiction. The highly intelligent life forms of Alpha Centauri can hardly restrain their incredulity when shown pictures of Homo sapiens. Life forms themselves are unreasonable in Chalmers' terms. They're not in any way entailed by the apparent nature of the universe. So, it's with an explanation of qualia as a feature of living organisms that I propose to address now, and in doing so, I will in fact introduce a more general explanation of conscious processes. Now, we're used, as philosophers, to distinguish why, how come, from why, what for? But we're also used to being reminded by people like Darwin and Dawkins and Dennett that in evolution, these questions have the same answer. That is to say, a new feature which arises by chance in a life form will be perpetuated if it does serve some purpose. How come? Is not driven by intention, by what for, but it is preserved by being for something useful, something that promotes reproductive success. So, reproductive success. All organisms coordinate their own activities to interact with their environment. They seek and exploit what they need to flourish. They avoid or cope with threats to their survival. And to accomplish this, evolution has built up vast arrays of interactive algorithms that work, and work well, without ever the organism being conscious of them. Plants are an outstanding example. Nothing whatever suggests that there is anything that it is like to be a plant. You may consider the lilies of the field, but I'm pretty sure they don't. Now, animals also benefit from instinct. We do. Our neural system deals continuously with the vital business of breathing, circulating blood, digesting, maintaining our cells. It runs complex coordination, for example, of our bodily posture whenever we walk or sit down. And none of this need we attend to. The neural algorithms are all there to do. Indeed, if there is a truly inner life, It is surely all this that goes on that we're not conscious of. The unseen workings of 30-odd trillion cells, including 6 billion neurons. The algorithms are there because of our evolution, i.e. because they have made for relatively successful reproduction, but in order to qualify for this inheritance process, the situations dealt with must be repetitive. And my thesis is that our conscious mode, including qualia, is a way of dealing with the one-off. And my account relies on two features which distinguish all conscious activity, including perception. One, conscious activity is selective. It focuses narrowly on one object at a time. Not only selective, it appears to be selected, chosen by us. Attention is single-minded. And the second feature, conscious activity deals with a highly edited version of that chosen object. How do these features mark our sensory perception? Well, take vision. Of the many things in our visual space, we consciously attend to only a very small part at any time. Not only that, we can and do shift that narrow focus, apparently on purpose. If you see the wood, you do not see a tree. If you see a tree, you don't see the wood. If you look at the leaf, you hardly see the branch. Same goes for sound. You have come across what is called the cocktail effect. The ability to concentrate on what one person is saying in a whole buzz of people talking all around you. And that too seems to be tunable. You can cut out your immediate neighbour because you really want to listen to what the person at the next table is saying. Now, the other feature of our sensory experience is that it's not a complete and accurate representation of its cause or object. It's best regarded as an edited version. Aspects are selected, organized, shaped and formatted. Take vision again. Once a card or glance may take 20 milliseconds, in that time, some 30 million photons will be reflected to your eyes from each tiny surface in your focus. All that information is processed, selected, organized and presented in one simple version. A version that's intelligible. A version that enables me to pick this particular bunch or check it for disease. When we hear a noise, the sound waves vibrate 10 times to the second. Is that what we hear? I reckon that we hear a sound that is continuous until it changes in tone or pitch. If I hear an itch, I may be able to locate it consciously to 3 or 4 square millimeters of skin. That is, 3 or 4 million cells. But that simplification means I can deal with it by an equally simplified action. Scratch it! Yes. An action to be carried out by millions of nerves operating millions of cells. But in conscious executive mode, one top-down order. Selective focus on simplified version enables purposeful action in real time. and the same features give us the usefulness of conscious activity, other conscious activities. Take finding information from a printed page. First, there is indeed a perception process, but that's so much taken for granted that we award a special title to those who can remember the actual appearance of the page. We call it photographic memory. But then, just consider how much information there is in a sentence. Take this one, precisely 100 characters using only the English alphabet and space. Now, if you count only English alphabet and space, and ignore uppercase and punctuation, we've got 27 options for each character. So there are 27 to the power of 100 unique sentences of this length, and this is just one of them. Count them. And in conscious mode, just how long does it take us to focus on the relevant and get information in a human sense? Something that makes a difference for our purpose? Hardly a second. But for that second, it had your attention. Or perhaps I'm trying to choose a present for my sister, and that could occupy my conscious mind almost exclusively for 10 minutes. And then, well, just how many items I could work through just from Amazon. My conscious mind, however, restricts the operate options to a manageable few and concentrates only on the relevant features of each. Simplified version. In all conscious activity, then, we have these two features. And thus, Dennett's analogy. Consciousness is like a user interface. Focus on one thing, presentation of that one thing in an edited version, something we can grasp and respond to in real time. By attention and simplification, in conscious mode, we escape from the repetitive patterns developed in evolution. We deal with new situations. We find new ways to tackle old ones. Now, consciousness may not be the only way. Evolution doesn't guarantee that. It may not be the best way. Evolution doesn't guarantee that either. But it has been a highly effective way. It has made us human beings the most adaptable and inventive of all creatures. Which, to me, supplies a pretty good explanation of why we have this remarkable mode of operation, qualia and all. It is indeed a marvel, but it's not a mystery.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. And so if I could ask, if there are questions, will you put your hand up, make sure that you've caught my eye before you put your hand down again. So then we'd like to start us off. Yes, please, Alan. Wait for the microphone to come around, please.
Thank you, Jonathan. I got stuck right at the start of your talk when you were talking about quality. But you seem to be saying there is nothing it is like to feel angry with your example. And you said feeling angry is the same as being angry, and being angry is a physical activity or something along those lines. That seems to me to be blurring the notion of anger, which is, in primary sense, the name of a feeling. And feeling angry is not necessarily expressed in being angry in the sense of behaving in an angry fashion. So it seems to me just a matter of example of colour as perception, and indeed a more basic case for the analysis of consciousness.
I'm not sure that I got all that, because apart from having one eye, I've only got one ear. But my point was that there is something that it's like to be angry. Yes, it is just being angry. So, and that it is physically not a mystery at all. You can just sort of look at the great wash of chemicals that produce this or that unbalanced disposition of the mind.
Produced.
Hmm?
Produced. It's not the same as.
Well, okay, I mean, let's produce, same as. If you want a difference, I'll accept there's a difference. I think, you know, of the speakers so far, I go mostly with those who say that we're talking about the same process, simply observed from a different point of view or angle. But thank you.
Is it going to work? Okay, good. I think you've distinguished emotion from feeling, in a sense, or maybe we're trying not to do that, but if, you know, and the emotion, if you like, is anger, and that might actually motivate you in some way, but the feeling is something a little bit different, isn't it? From the emotion. That's the distinction that's sometimes made. I wonder if the feeling is more like what you think.
Well, Chalmers himself actually uses the term emotion. So I did. And it's the emotions that I was thinking of and deciding to exclude from my discussion, partly because, as I said, it seemed to me that they lend themselves readily when they're so powerful that they do become emotions, passions, things that we are passive in rather than things that we are organising or doing, that they are not objective, they're not productive, in fact they're counterproductive typically. So I propose to just leave them out.
Right.
Something we probably do better without.
Okay.
So a bit anti my evolutionary. If it doesn't serve some purpose, we wouldn't have it. But there we are.
Well, I think from the terms of the emotions, say triggering an action of some kind, but maybe the same emotion would always trigger the same action because of some other associated thing. So you may feel angry, whether or not you kick the stone on the ground or hit somebody, is something that's governed in some other way.
I think one of the things about emotion is it's terribly emotions of this kind are terribly unselective.
Yes.
In other words, there may have been this particular thing that I was angry about, but my anger isn't confined to that. You know, I'll react angrily when somebody talks to me, or when something falls on the floor, or when the television goes on. It just takes me over for a bit. So I decided to, as it were, leave it out as something that I wanted to discuss, if you like.
Question from Paul.
Yes, I only have one name. Sorry, I'll spell out. You seem to be worshipping the author of evolution very much, and actually, this leaving out anger, I mean, my goodness, passions, reason, as we know, Hume said, is and ought to be, we can talk about ought to be, the slave of the passions. The passions are very much part of who we are and our consciousness. And we here, sitting in this hall here, probably do think about why we are angry, because we have a propensity to be philosophers. So I think leaving that out, and you haven't in any way explained what consciousness is. You see, he said there may be a purpose. I said, I think that was right, because it may help us reproduce. But then, where is evolution going? It's the blind watchmaker. It's not going anywhere, but particularly it's not progressive. Yeah. No, I think you have not explained the metaphysics of how we
I take your point, and I mean, I obviously did underplay emotions, but take the point that if you're walking through a forest and there is something, a loud noise, you will switch into fight or flee mode without consciously thinking. The adrenaline will flow and you will be suddenly prepared for something awful to happen. But one of the advantages to me of a conscious mind is that you then think of it and you say, hold on a minute, I wonder what that was, etc. So you operate at two levels, and I can't remember the brain names for the two parts of them. One lot of sensations or perceptions comes without any conscious mediation, and then another lot you can actually focus on and attend to. And for my mind, what makes us humans good at survival is not that we switch into fight or flee when we hear the loud noise, but that we then think about it and take deliberate conscious action to think through what the real terrors are likely to be, and that way we survive on the whole rather more often to our natural term than most other animals do.
And Jonathan, returning to feelings again, one way of dealing with them in AI tradition, and that's only one way, there are others, which I wondered whether you would actually agree with and which would resolve some of these questions, is to view feelings and emotions, which are stronger feelings, as kind of a cognitive bias, something which sways our reasoning in one direction or another. Would that fit with your conception?
The term I use, which I think goes with that, is that it feels like an invasion of consciousness, a sort of takeover. And I'll stick with that. It affects the way we look at not just whatever caused it, but at everything. When we're depressed, everything looks bloody low. Yeah, but cognitive bias, fine.
Jonathan, thank you for that. It was very clear. I was reminded of a saying in relation to Eastern philosophy, where I think in justifying the self, they say that the observer cannot be the observed. You spoke in the latter end of your talk about presentation of the edited versions of focused information. My question is presentation to what and how, because I think that's the nub of our discussion.
Good question, thank you. In my little handout, which was not meant to be a summary of my talk, but I did put one of the points in which I go either different from or further than Dennett. In my model, the self of which we are conscious, the user of the user interface, is itself a highly edited version of an extraordinarily complicated organism. But actually what goes on that constitutes, Dennett talks about the centre of narrative gravity, what goes on as we lead our conscious lives seems to me very like a story in which the protagonist, the hero, the self, a highly edited version of a human being, faces a number of situations, highly edited, organized presentations of social and physical, environmental situations, copes with them, but copes with them, and this would be my point, in real time. I don't think we have my point about unconscious activities is, on the one hand, we don't have, as far as I can see, algorithms that have taught me through several hundred thousand years of evolution how to choose a birthday present for my sister. And on the other hand, that in unconscious mode, and I think I've no idea what aspects of choosing a present for my sister or why that should occupy my time rather than anything else. A lot of things are going on that I could concentrate on. Somehow this heroic self, it's an invention, chooses a particular topic. Wait a minute, I've got to do this whatever thing, focuses the attention on it for whatever time it takes, and comes up with a practical solution. Whereas if I consulted every one of my 86 billion neurons one at a time, I think it might take me, you know, I might be late for the birthday.
Got any other questions?
Anybody
else? Tim.
Hi, excellent talk. Can I ask one very simple question? If you were to program a computer to function in exactly the way you described, with this executive sort of information accessible across the system, in the sort of way that the workspace of Dennett's theories suggest, if you programmed it to work in that way, do you personally believe that computer would gain consciousness?
No.
Or why not?
Well, evolutionarily, I can't see, you know, what would be the point. To my mind, we have developed consciousness as living organisms because it helps us deal with things that make for survival. What a computer needs to do to make for survival is to go on being useful and not to tell me that it's to wait because it's configuring something for 2 minutes when I want to get on with my work. Otherwise, I'll throw it through the window. I just don't see what there is about. I think I used this one, but it was in private talk. There's a professor of information who just said, you know, people have tried to find a robot washer-up and produce pictures of robots sort of handling dishes and running them through the water and drying them and so on. And then he said, now I'll show you a robot dishwasher, and he showed you a machine dishwasher. You don't need to operate like a human. And I don't see any reason why a computer should need to, or why we should need it to. It just doesn't seem to me to be a likely event, or one that we would aim for, except some AI buffs who want to get some more funding.
Could we do it if we tried, if we wanted to do that, to build that computer?
Sorry?
Could we do it if we tried, if we wanted to build that computer with consciousness?
I think I'm just a meat machine, so the answer is, in principle, yep.
One final question.
This might be a more very serious one, but you mentioned you've chosen the present for your sister, and I'm just wondering, how would this act improve your reproductive capability?
Sure, I didn't, unfortunately, that sounded good, but I didn't quite hear. Could somebody repeat?
The lady said about you choosing a present for your sister, how did that also improve your ability in reproductive system?
Well, good question. For a start, and this is rather more general than a particular instance, my social network very much improves or enhances or conditions my chances of reproductive success. It isn't just that I should know people, but that they should know me as somebody, you know, as charismatic and charming as I obviously am. So I, you know, at a pinch, I'll be very glad of my sister's good word when I'm making a pitch.